sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Another week, another record for stocks. Massive gain in employment is the reason. India leads and Russia lags. Our guest today, Chris Martinson. He is with peakprosperity.com. A lot of interesting things we're going to talk to him about. We have lots to go over. All this and so much more on episode number 391 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. Andrew Horowitz here. We just finished the first week of December 2014. And yes, it is a new record, Irene. We have new records on the S&P 500, new records on the Dow Jones Industrial, the culmination of the stimulus measures being provided by countries around the world, as well as a better economic outlook in the U.S. has investors all aflurry, all excited. You know, we saw that this week we put on about 321,000 new jobs. That was the BLS report. Actually, last month also, there was an adjustment higher on the numbers. The unemployment rate is at 5.8%. That didn't change. And that may be actually good because we're seeing that more people entering the workforce. You know, what we saw for some time was that the unemployment rate would come down, and that was due to the fact that there was a labor participation rate that fell, but this time we're seeing that it's holding up. Now, mind you, yes, there is some better numbers here, much better than anticipated by, I think, everyone. I don't think any analyst, any economist had any idea that we would see this much of a rise in payrolls, and the dollar had the best day in years. Dollar was up like 2% against major currencies around the world. The euro fell, the yen fell. And what was really, I think, interesting was that there was really a good, solid number overall. But one thing, just one takeaway from it, if we can just make sure we're looking at this very objectively, was there was some seasonality in it. And that seasonality for the number that we saw, of course, was due to the fact that retail establishments were hiring more and hiring more on a part-time basis for the holidays, which is natural. It's a seasonal situation that happens pretty much every year. Now, did it happen to an excess this time, or was it normal? Well, we'll see how we're going to fare when it comes to the next couple of months. We already know that many of the retail establishments are feeling a little bit of pain. There's some real pain in the specialty apparel area for young ladies and for teens. We're seeing that that is really a very soft spot right now, and we'll see there's going to be a lot of layoffs in that area as well in the next coming months. But right now, all things being considered, it was an excellent number, and it shows that the economy is doing well overall. Employment is a very important number. Remember, at the end of the day, we could look at housing, we could look at manufacturing, we could look at CPI, PPI, industrial production, capacity utilization. We could look at any of these numbers. At the end of the day, it's employment that matters. And the reason for that is, as you know, it's very simple. It's the more people that are working, the more money is being made, the more money that's being made and in circulation and involved in the economy, the more money that is spent. That makes sense? It's very simple. So the good news is that we are seeing a better hiring, and that should go a long way to ensure that there is optimism in the markets. So, what is going on otherwise? Well, we are still seeing that a significant change in the outlook for the major countries such as Germany, Italy, France, by Mario Draghi last week, saying that they're really taking a real, just a tremendous toll on their economies due to a lot of the deflationary pressures that we're seeing, as well as the fact that the Russian sanctions are hurting them tremendously. We've talked about that. And even as their euro, their currency is dropping, still a very weak spot. That's number one. Probably the biggest thing that's happening around the world that's the biggest concern, although it's being offset by the continuation of stimulus discussions. Now, on Thursday, was it Thursday or Wednesday, now that I think about it, last week, midweek, let's just say that, okay? Midweek last week, Mario Draghi came out with a discussion about his outlook and some of the ECB, the things that the ECB will be doing in order to stimulate the economy, and he fell short of really stipulating when, in fact, there was going to be some kind of asset purchases. Now, there was a lot of anticipation going into that discussion, into that speech. In fact, there was a lot of disappointment after that speech because he didn't really outline any significant date or amount. Keeps on pushing it off to sometime in the future. Now, markets didn't react very well to that. U.S. was kind of marginally down, but in the European region, they were down 1.5% across the board. And wouldn't you know it, on Friday, coming into the weekend, amazingly, there was some leak of information about how there could be some kind of asset purchase as early as January. Now, Mario Draghi always is very much attuned to the market, so who knows what that means exactly, but at the end of the day, Mario Draghi is going to do what he can to talk it up, jawbone it, and blather about what it is he's going to do. We'd like to see what he really will be doing, but that's the case around that scenario. In China, there's a lot of speculation that there will be a decrease in rates a couple of more times by the end of the year. We're only talking about 3 weeks or so to the end of the year. And there's a lot of discussion that possibly a cut to the reserve ratios at the banks. There's a cut to interest rates, maybe two before the end of the year, because China's economy is slowing much more quickly than anticipated. And of course, in Japan, the same old, same old. We saw that oil hit a new five-year low, about $64.50 for oil. And that's a bit of a concern, questions about demand and questions about if OPEC really is going to be able to keep a hold of the pricing where they need it to become profit or to maintain profitability, and if we're going to see that they are going to have the ability to break the backs of the shale region in the U.S. and the oil services and exploration companies in the U.S. But really, the big news is the markets. A lot of excitement about a lot of names. We saw that Ambarella, a name that I've been talking about for some time, it reported earnings. Their earnings were better than estimated, and things looked okay, but it wasn't a blowout number by any means, and the stock took off about 2% on the downside after the earnings results, after a major upward move that they've made for some time. That's really not the worst thing that could happen. I will tell you something. I'm going to keep a watch on something. I mentioned that I got, I think on the DH Unplugged show this week, two things. First of all, I finally got my iPhone 6, but I got a GoPro. I got the GoPro 4 and the newest product they have out there. I thought it would be fun just to check out and see really what the capabilities of this little device is. It's so small, so interesting. It does some very cool things. First of all, it has an underwater housing that's good down to supposedly 131 feet. It has a great compression ratio. It has an okay battery. Battery's not that great, by the way. Had it out over the weekend and took some videos for a bit, and it really didn't last that long. And we had it charged up, I thought, pretty well. And this wide-angle lens feature that it has is pretty neat. It looks like it's taking videos from a pretty long way away, which is really nice. Very high definition, good quality. Has a little microphone built in. One of the things that does concern me, and I haven't gotten to this yet, so I'll tell you when I get to it how this plays out, but what is the editing feature, the ability to take a video or a sequence of videos from start to finish and compile them into a video story, a video that you can then present? What kind of software is involved with this, the learning curve to understand how to use it, and then eventually to produce it to be some kind of a file that can be viewable and send, you know, you can send it out and take a look at it on whether it's a YouTube or send it to people. I'm kind of curious. I've been asking some people that I know that have the GoPro whether or not it's a kind of a novelty at this point. You know, what was their impression of it? Are they using it? And I did talk to somebody just this weekend who said that they love their GoPro. Great device. They did things like they went fishing with it and they attached it to the pole and they attached it and went underwater and saw the fish come up. All these really cool things. And I said, well, how long ago did you get that? He said a few months ago. I said, are you still using it? Not so much. I said, have you been editing any of the videos? They're mostly just stored on my computer and I can take a look at them when I want. But it's a little bit repetitious. I do the same thing over and over. That's my hobby. That's my sport. I go on the boat. I do some fishing. I do some scuba. And, you know, how much of the same thing can you take? And I started thinking about that because I was kind of curious about how that all plays out. You know, you have the situation where you have the, the videos that you're taking and doesn't it get a little bit boring after a while for the same thing over and over? I don't know. I just thought that was something that was interesting and whether or not people will really want this as a have-to-have item versus a novelty. A have-to-have item is something that will really do well over the holiday season. I'm certain of this. Everybody, I think this is probably the gift. Maybe an Apple iPhone, maybe a new Samsung device. But generally speaking, this is probably the gift for the holidays. And if so, how is this going to play out post-holidays? Is there still going to be such a demand for this? Is there still going to be a tremendous amount of desire to have this kind of device as a gift, as something you have to buy? And where does the novelty wear off, if it does? We've seen this with so many other products in the past. So I'm going to keep a watch on this. This is on my short radar. I'm telling you right now. This is one of those shorts that could be a short of the year for next year. Question is, when will that play out? I think that their earnings are going to be coming out in February. So they're going to get a good part of the holiday season and the holiday quarter selling season and selling period in that particular period for their earnings. So we may have to look out past that. But I would venture to say that if, in fact, the novelty does wear off somewhere in about late February into March, April, this stock could do quite the nosedive at the valuations that we're seeing now. We'll keep a watch on that. Now, we did also see a big sell-off this week after the employment numbers for bonds. As the dollar rose, we saw gold come in. We saw oil come in, various commodities come in, but also the bond. This is a big question whether or not this is going to be the time when bonds actually finally, that, you know, the big anticipation of bonds, the big sell-off is going to happen. The thing that people have been talking about for the last 2-3 years where, wow, bond prices are the lowest they've been in history, or bond yields, I should say, are the lowest they've been in history. Bond prices are the highest they've been in history. And man, this is going to be a big shakeup. There's going to be a tremendous amount of selling going on. It's going to be an implosion of the bond market. Remember something. We still have the government buying about $10 billion of bonds per month. They're still involved in the market. We still have the Fed who needs to keep yields low. It's in the best interest of the country. It's in the best interest of their portfolio of about $4 trillion of assets of bonds that they hold. So I think something has to give here, but I do question when it's going to be when you have a government that can print unlimited amounts of money and governments around the world that are printing money. And what are they doing with it? Well, they're buying stocks and bonds. They're putting it back into their economies. But a lot of the money has been coming over this way, as we have seen from flows, fund flows that we've seen from international players over the last several months. All right. Now, I wanted to talk to you about some of the top and bottom sectors that we've seen recently and a few other things, but I thought first we'd get to our guest. All right. We're with our special guest today, Chris Martinson, and he is an interesting fellow because he has quite a bit of background in all sorts of areas, which we'll get into, but he's a co-founder of peakprosperity.com, one of the early econo bloggers who very well predicted and forecasted the housing market collapse and stock market correction years in advance. So I know you have a book out also that's called The Crash Course. It's been published by Wiley. And I have a lot of questions to ask you and one of the things to talk to you about. So first of all, welcome to the show. I appreciate you coming on board.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me. It's good to be here.
So just to kind of set this up, I know that you were the former, was it the vice president of Pfizer?
No, that's a little inaccurate on Wiki. We're trying to get that changed, but it's been tricky. Vice president of a company called Science Applications International Corp. I was in corporate finance at Pfizer.
So You weren't the king of Prussia either.
No, I was not, unfortunately. But we're trying to get that fixed.
I'm kidding. Anyway,
so the king of Transylvania. We all know that. Come on.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that I think we want to make sure we're clear about. First of all, what is the whole idea of peak prosperity?
Well, it's the idea that there's lots of ways that we can be prosperous. So you think about peak conditioning, you know, your peak performance. So that's the first play on the word, is that we believe that there are lots of ways that we can be prosperous. But as well, there's this dark side to that. There's the shadow side of that term, which is that we believe that the way in which the humans have decided to organize themselves economically was all built around this idea of cheap energy. We don't have cheap oil anymore. Prices can go up or down, I don't care, but the amount of energy it takes to get that oil out of the ground is now rising and rising sharply. And so there is a peak in, we believe, the way we've economically organized ourselves. So it's really saying there's some big changes coming.
Okay, so that being the case, and the whole idea that a lot of the things that we do is we consume energy, we consume food, and maybe looking at a different way is we're stripping the assets of the world, right? I mean, that's really what mm-hmm. we're doing. Some people would say, well, you know, we're at the top of the food chain and we can do it, so that's not a bad thing. And there's others that say, hey, wait a minute, you're going to ruin this. Maybe not right now, but for future generations. I'm not sure.
Well, absolutely that happens. You're down in Florida. You know what happened when people went out and started catching grouper out of the ocean, and eventually they caught so many, they went through the breeding stock, and there was a general collapse in the amount and size of fish and all of that. So yes, humans can have an impact, and we are also capable, if we choose, to understand how to manage things well. And so I think we're at that part of our human history where we say we go from saying we can just mindlessly, you know, rip across new landscapes and just consume as much as we want to saying, hey, we can clearly overconsume. What kind of world do we want to live in? That's a little bit more complicated. We have to limit ourselves. We have to understand, you know, how we're going to interact with the world. So that's part of this conversation too. And that's what's happening right now, is we're running into very clear limits with water, soil, oil, you name it, just natural stuff. And for me, that's an organizing framework for understanding how the future is going to unfold, both for challenges and opportunities.
You know, we are in the same general generation. I'm not at 50 yet. I just like to proudly say that. Although it's coming soon. Much too soon, actually, within months.
But it always does. Yeah.
So when I was a kid, you know, the thought of buying bottled water, first of all, that was not a thought. It wasn't even in the consciousness of anything, even if you were to go out with some weird Star Trek concept, you know, it just wasn't there, right? You drank water out of the tap. I'm from New York. We drank it out of the hose, for that matter. We drank mm-hmm. it out of water fountains. You know, today it's almost like, ew, you're drinking water out of the tap. And there's a lot of reasons why that's a problem, of course, but it's kind of different. You know, when, you know, food back then, it's kind of like you just ate whatever it was. And these days you want to make hormone-free, gluten-free. There's a whole different change of things. I mean, when I was a kid, did you know anybody that was allergic to peanuts?
No.
No. I mean, you know, and you got on an airplane, you had peanuts. That was it. And I don't remember anybody having problems with that. I mean, did you know anybody that wore a helmet riding their bicycle?
No. No, no, we did not do that.
And if you did, you'd beat the crap out of them, probably.
Probably, yeah.
Right? So there's a change in the whole, I think, the attitude. And tell me if I'm wrong about this, but is it all about, hey, I want to live longer? And I want to enjoy more? Because, again, when I was young, very young, the idea that I remember was, okay, you work till you're 50, 55, 60. You retire at 60, 65. You drop dead to 75. That was kind of like the game. Mm-hmm. And now it's kind of like, okay, you work till, let's say, 60, 65, and you live till 90. That's a whole different parameter of a potential lifespan.
It absolutely is. And, you know, you're pointing to something that's, I think, really, really fundamental here, which is that in the United States, we've somehow flipped into not just health conscious, but safety conscious, as you're hinting at with the helmet piece. And we're asking for complete safety in all moments. And I don't think that's something that's either achievable or desirable, because, you know, when you're safe in all moments, you know, life happens at the edges. And we did a lot of edgy things as a kid. We did things that, frankly, could have gone horribly wrong, me and my buddies.
Yeah.
And they didn't. And we learned from them. And somehow most of us, nearly all of us, survived and grew up. And that was part of life. And so I'm raising my own children with plenty of edge experiences and letting them work stuff out. And people look at me like I'm insane. Yeah. But I, you know, my daughter, when she's 19, she said, I want to go to Europe. So we said, great, plan it. And she did. And she went, gave us no itinerary. She was just flying into Edinburgh, worked it all out, came back with stories 3 months later. And it was great. But people thought we were insane. Mm-hmm. Like, how could you let your daughter travel alone? I'm like, well, she's 19. Once upon a time, you know, she could have been drafted into the army a year ago and shot up on some foreign battlefield. Mm-hmm. So 19 feels mature to me, and I truly think that we've lost something by demanding so much safety in all moments. That's one side of the coin. The other side is, you know, we're finding out that a lot of the foods we're feeding ourselves are actually toxic. Mm-hmm. And we can see that in obesity rates. We can see that in climbing levels of mental health imbalances. We're discovering things about how the gut and the biome works. And so there's some science coming along to say, hey, you know the way your granddad ate? You'd probably want to emulate that a little bit more, you know, because there was something okay about that.
Now, you're up in the northern part where it snows. Did you, let's just talk about how edgy we're talking about here. Did you allow your kids to skitch?
To what?
Skitch.
Skitch? What's that?
That's when you grab on the back of a bumper of a car when it's icy out and just go.
No, I guess I haven't seen them do that yet, but.
we used to do that.
Yeah, well, I did too. We used to run behind the DDT fog trucks too. Yeah. Not everything was good.
All right, so let's talk about this in the aspect, now that we set the stage a little bit, of safety on all measures and all accounts. Let's talk about that and translate this to finance. Because right now it seems like we want to have that underlying hand of God, which then I think is translated to central banks, governments, to ensure that, hey, my investments are safe. In the old days, whenever that was, you invested and it was kind of like whatever would happen. You know, once upon a time, there wasn't FDIC. Once upon a time, there wasn't pension insurance. Once upon a time, you know, we could say all these things. But now it's almost like investors, and not only individual investors, really institutions too, are really reliant on central banks. And they, in your opinion, from my reading, are really to blame for a lot of things that are that have happened and that will happen. Let's go through some of that.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, this was a great way to tee this up, talking about smoothing out risk in life, because really under Greenspan, the Central Bank of the United States and others followed suit shortly thereafter. Under Greenspan, the Federal Reserve said, hey, you know what we think we can do? We think we can defeat the business cycle. Why have things go down after they go up? You know, completely ignoring, like any good economist working at the Fed would, that during the up phase, people do some goofy things. They start companies called pets.com. They sell houses to people who have credit scores in the 500s. You know, they do dumb stuff. And that always happens during the up phase. And so the inevitable down phase is to rinse all that bad stuff out. Schumpeter's creative destruction. You burn away all the bad stuff. What's left is the good stuff. And you pick up and you keep moving. So history has always been that sort of a line wobbling its way upwards, right? And under Greenspan, the Fed said, hey, we think we can eliminate that nasty down part. That part's unpleasant. We'll just only have up. You know, we're only going to breathe in, no breathing out. And the admirable as that was sort of in its intent, it was just completely and utterly clueless. And what we've seen, you know, the first rescue actually happened in 1994. That's when we had a small glitch in the corporate credit markets. Greenspan fixed that by doing something called the sweeps programs were implemented, which allowed banks to effectively sweep their demand accounts out of view so that they didn't have to can have any reserve requirements. Great. So the banks are now completely unfettered from lending. They lent to corporations, and they gave us the internet boom and the craze and the bust that came from that. Well, in response to that accident, which was a little one, you know, in the corporate market, gave us a bigger accident in the stock market. And in response, drove interest rates to 1% because they had to engineer this. No down cycle can be allowed. Gave us a housing bubble, which was an even bigger accident. And now they've driven interest rates to zero, and they've set us up for what I think is going to be the granddaddy of all accidents. So in their desire to remove risk, what they did is they raised a bunch of kids who didn't know how to fall off a bike safely, who didn't understand that being 30 steps up a stepladder can lead to bad things if you're not careful. They've created this perception, but not the reality, that risk has been eliminated, and it never can be eliminated. It will come back, but this time bigger and I think worse than ever before.
Well, one of the things that's also different from back at that time was that, I'm thinking through this for a second, I think that Greenspan and the U.S. Had a disproportional effect on world economics. And we were the only ones who were taking that kind of risk to try to say that, hey, there is no business cycle and we are going to fix it and therefore fix the world. Now, we've done some of that under Bernanke with some of the backdoor loans that we gave to Europe and some of the things that we've done to bring down interest rates. But now what's happened is, now is where it gets out of control. Everybody's like, ah, we can do that too, even if they can't.
Well, of course, look at Japan, right? Japan is on QE 9 or 90 or whatever it is. They've been trying QE essentially for 28 years now. And of course, the criticism that the monetarists kick out, like Paul Krugman or you know, Bernanke, now that he's on the lectured circuit, is they just didn't do enough of it. You know, but what's enough, right? They already have total credit market debt in Japan, including, you know, private and public, is now roughly $1 million per person of debt that they're carrying somewhere on their books. And then people go, oh, but they owe it to themselves. Like, that's fine, but still, each person's associated with $1 million of debt, whether they owe it to foreigners, which is a little more toxic, but or to themselves. Either they're going to have to pay that back or they're not going to be able to. They can't at this point, right? Mm-hmm. And instead of looking at that and saying, wow, that really didn't work and probably was ill-advised to take on more and more debt given the demographic reality, which is that it's an aging population that's not a dynamic economy from a demographic standpoint, and it's a falling population. That's not a recipe for needing more and more aggressive growth. But the bankers don't know anything. All they know is they have to see credit market debt growing constantly. That's the mindset they're locked into. And it's gotten so extreme that who even batted an eyelash? It was just a month and a half ago, right? Kuroda comes out, head of the Bank of Japan, and says, we're going to monetize 100% of all new government issuance. We're going to buy even more bonds beyond that. And we're going to be buying 3 trillion yen per month of stocks. We're buying stocks directly because that man, Kuroda, and the 8 people who sit around his table know best what the correct price for money, for bonds, and for stocks are. And by God, they're going to get that.
Now, what's interesting is that it seems to be that there is a fear factor that is involved with the various central banks. They cannot stomach a drop in markets. I'm talking about financial asset prices. Now, you look back to what happened a couple months ago in the U.S. We had about an 8-9% drop in the S&P, and we saw about a 12-13% drop in the small caps. And right when things were getting a little hairy, the central bankers started their parade. They started talking about how, you know what, by the way, well, maybe we won't slow down our bond purchases, or maybe we'll renew them if we have to, or maybe we're going to extend out when we're going to have to raise interest rates, etc. Are they fearful? Are they concerned? What is their story?
You know, it would have been unthinkable 10 years ago that when there was a minor market correction that you would have this parade of Fed officials coming out and saying, whoa, careful, you know, we might buy more. QE's not over yet. And it was absolutely, I think, comically ridiculous and also tragic when you saw the case of Bullard, mm-hmm. right? The Fed official Bullard. Yep. Right before the stock market correction came forward, he said, yeah, we're pretty much done with this QE thing. You know, we're done. And so the market correctly said, oh, we're all out of free money, and it started to fall off. And then it was October 15th. He trots right back out again and says, whoa, what I meant was we're not done, and we're probably going to buy as much as necessary whenever. Does it only concern you and me that the Fed officials feel it necessary to intervene in the markets on a daily basis when they haven't even undergone what a normal person would call a reasonable or decent correction?
Yep.
What are they? Their fear makes me worried.
I don't understand why they're so out there. I mean, it's almost like Mario Draghi speaks twice a week saying the same blathering about how they're going to, you know, have more stimulus. And what's really interesting about this, it's not so much that he says this thing multiple times, is that the market will react positively, or according to his discussion, they push down the euro further, or they have their markets rise every time he says it. It's like, you just said that last week. Why are we reacting further to this now? It's amazing.
Well, you know, here's where I really wish that we could get a public audit of the central banks. And I think we're due one because they're public institutions and they're managing the public money. Let's agree to something. Money is not real. It's a concept. It's an idea. And they print it out of thin air. So how they're managing it is just so in the public interest. It makes no sense to me that the public can't peer into their books. But here's what I think we'd find when we get into those books. We know for a fact that the Chicago Mercantile Exchange has a special discount program in their futures division for various key players. And the more you buy, the bigger the discount you get. The ones with some of the greatest, fattest discounts are under what they call their central bank program. So the Chicago Mercantile Exchange has a grouping, which is like, hey, central banks that want to play in the futures markets, here's your price. And we got a good one for you because you guys are such valued customers. Which central banks are those that are intervening in the futures markets? Well, we know that Chicago Mercantile Exchange has them as a client group, so we know they're buying stuff. Maybe it's just Kuroda, but if it's other ones out there, then let me connect a couple dots. The central bankers come out, they open their mouths, they say a few words, and the markets go up. I would love to know who's doing the buying right at that moment after that statement comes out, because it wouldn't surprise me anymore, based on all the stuff that's happened in these last few years, to find out that Draghi says, hey, team, I'm going to go out and I'm going to make an announcement. It would be very nice if I had some substantive rally in the market right after I finish talking. That would, I think, put a nice exclamation point on that. We can then write press releases that say, hey, the market cheered my words. You know,
frightening. That would be very frightening. Well, it's frightening enough that sovereign wealth funds are actively involved in markets. It's frightening enough that Japan will actively go and purchase securities. Or on the other hand, I could say it's really kind of terrible that the U.S. has to go through such a process to raise risk asset prices when they could just be directly buying instead of going through all this shenanigans that they go through to try to get the buying going on.
Yeah, and you know what's coming next, right? So the point of a big article I just wrote and published yesterday was that despite all of this, all the central bankers have to show for their efforts so far are increases in stock markets and also select bond markets. And that's all they've got. Do they have the organic growth that's required and necessary to justify these very elevated prices in these financial assets? And the answer is no. Europe's right at stall speed collectively, but that's a composition of a few countries that are above stall speed and a bunch of them that are actually already in recession. Japan's in recession at this point in time. China is slowing down like crazy. So we're seeing this global network of what seems to be a global slowdown. And we could also detect that in falling iron ore prices for fashioning steel. We're looking at cement prices falling. Copper, Dr. Copper is way down. Oil, look at oil prices. Any one of those are down, markets happen. But when all four of those are down, I go, well, that's pretty much your economic bellwether.
Yeah, but on the other side, you're saying, well, the reality is that it's not because of demand. It's because the dollar is moving higher, and you get that whole thing going on. But let me kind of go through what this whole idea of this something that you called a crash course, which is the book that you wrote. And you talk about there the eye drop of water in the middle of the stadium. Now, I can get a visual on that, but kind of talk about that a little bit.
Well, this is a very important concept, and it relates to the idea of exponential growth. And the reason I talk about exponential growth is because we're surrounded by it. You know, our credit markets are growing exponentially. The number of people on the planet has been growing exponentially. The amount of oil we're burning it exponentially more each year. And so here's the idea. For something to grow exponentially, all it has to do is grow by some percentage over time. 5% per year, 10% per minute, 0.25% per century, it doesn't matter. And you get this thing called a hockey stick chart, which we've all seen, right? This chart that sort of shoots up. But nobody, except for a few math geeks, really understands the implications of that. So here's a thought experiment. It works like this. So imagine that I have a magic eyedropper of water. And the reason it's magic is that when it drops a drop of water out, that drop of water is going to double every minute. So after 1 minute, you have 2 drops. And after 2 minutes, you have 4 drops. And after 3 minutes, you have 8 drops, right? So about 5 minutes into this story, you can fill a thimble up with the water that you got out of this magic eyedropper. So now we go to the stadium. And it really doesn't matter which stadium anybody picks in their mind. So pick the biggest stadium in your mind you've ever been to and imagine that it's watertight and that you're handcuffed to the highest row of bleacher seats in the stadium. Now, here's the thought experiment. It's 12 o'clock at noon.
Are there cheerleaders? Because that would make it more comfortable.
Yeah, and you have to get them out of their handcuffs,
okay,
too.
Gotcha, okay, right,
so
gotcha.
So there's a little rescue mission here, right? Now, are you with me?
I'm with you.
Excellent. So we start this at 12 o'clock. Say 12 o'clock tomorrow. at, right in the afternoon, and I put this magic drop down right at the 50-yard line on the pitcher's mound, whatever you're imagining. So imagine that, and it starts, the water starts to increase, right? And after 5 minutes, there's a thimble full of water in the field. The question is, how long do you have to get you and the cheerleaders out of your handcuffs?
I know the game of a penny a day doubled a day for 30 days gets ridiculous. So this is the same game.
It is.
And I would imagine that it's a lot shorter than I would think. But knowing that experiment, I would say it's probably 5 minutes of thimble. I would say under 2 hours.
Excellent. Excellent. You know, when I ask audiences this, you get all sorts of answers, right? You get people who say 10 minutes and people who say 4 years. The answer is it's 50 minutes.
Oh, boy.
Just 50 minutes. And if your stadium is twice as big as the one I used to calculate this, you can imagine 51 minutes, right?
Right, right. Exactly. So it's doubled.
It doubling right. gets out of control right. really fast on you. And here, that's not the most important question. Here's the important question. At what time, how many minutes in, was this park still 97% empty? And did you realize the seriousness of your predicament?
Right, exactly. It's also a similar discussion of, you know, having a pot of boiling water and throwing a toad in it, or heating it up slowly and having the toad boil. And the fact right. is, you know, it's when a stock market crashes quickly, it's like, okay, what's happening? Get out of it, whatever. Or if it's just something's overwhelming you slowly, carbon monoxide in a closed garage. So the thing is that what you're trying to say, I believe, is that we are in a situation where we are growing our debt exponentially around the world. We are not really feeling it because other things are maybe making us happy, you know, like watching the cheerleaders the whole time and not noticing this, but we see wealth assets moving up in price. And so generally speaking, there's nothing to worry about because there's been no cracks in the foundation. The question is, when the cracks come, it's too late.
Right. And so here's the important part of that. This park that we're in, or the stadium, is still 97% empty space 45 minutes into this story.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the last 5 minutes that things just all of a sudden fill up. And that's the nature. That's the one thing I want to communicate with these exponential functions is they speed up at the end. They speed up, right? They go really slow for a while, and then at the end, they speed up.
Right.
And that's what we're seeing. You know, you see all these people around going, oh, why is this wealth gap happening? Oh, this is, what do we need? You know, what are we doing about it? And I say, you know, if you give me 5 minutes, I'll explain. It's a feature of the system. When Bill Gates has more money than he can possibly spend, and he can't even possibly spend the interest on the money that he owns, then at some point it begins to compound faster and faster and faster. And in a debt-based money system, if you have enough rows in your spreadsheet, you can calculate this and prove that at the end of this game, one entity owns everything and everybody owes them. That's the direction we're heading, right? And that's not to say pro or con, or, you know, we hate rich people or we love poor people or any of that stuff. Forget that. It's just how the system works. It's a feature.
And what you're saying also is you talk about the idea that there is this wealth gap and this issue with the rich get richer, the poor maybe stay where they are. Let's just keep it that way versus the poor get poorer for a second. The middle class kind of, depending on where you are in the middle class, will kind of scoot along or not. The fact is that there's something inherently wrong with the rich getting so much richer. And with the aspect of that, it's almost impossible not to have that happen in an environment where we have such an easy money system, easy money environment, where there is a Fed who is prompting the system on a constant basis and feeding money into it. And where does it go? Well, some of it will drop down, but a lot of it stays on the top.
Well, absolutely. And so you can both accelerate and decelerate the rate at which you get this imbalance between rich and poor. What the Fed has been doing, and I wrote about this back in 2008, I knew they were going to print even back then. And I said that when they print, what we're going to find is that the rich are going to get richer, and there's a reason for that. The people who have access to that freshly printed money can make the most best use of it, and they're going to just siphon it off. And that's exactly what's happened. It's not a mystery. It happens, right? So, you know, the thing I as a social commentator I hate is this idea that my country, the United States, is heading in the same place where Ukraine currently is, right? A bunch of oligarchs, or a very few handful of oligarchs, and a whole bunch of people without anything. Plutarch, all the way back several thousand years ago, said that the oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics is an imbalance between the rich and poor. And so we're heading there, right? And the Federal Reserve has created that specifically, and they're enabling it and making it go faster. And it just drove me nuts. A month and a half ago, Janet Yellen comes out and gives a statement, a whole prepared set of remarks around this, the wealth gap. And, you know, with her crack research team, they come up with four reasons why we have this. And they basically boiled down to, y'all need to become better entrepreneurs. You should probably invest more in your children. And it really helps if you have wealthy parents.
Yeah, you know, yeah, well. and by the way,
so annoying.
And by the way, let them eat cake.
Exactly. You know? It's like,
right?
Really maddening.
Yeah.
Because she knows better. She has to know better. And she's that dumb. I'm even
worried. I find it fascinating how you go from somehow of a level-headed economist in regard to looking at all sorts of data to a central banker, where your job is essentially to be a cheerleader and absolutely never say anything that could, you know, rock markets, especially in the last 10 years. It's a remarkable thing, and it shows the lack of honesty and lack of courage, frankly. And let's not also forget about the fact that the dissenters, oftentimes in terms of the Fed policy measures, are often non-voting members. And that's, I think, pretty well set up.
Absolutely. Listen, you know, for anybody listening, if you didn't like how the Soviet Union and its central planning worked out, you're going to hate how this story ends, because ultimately this is central planning at its worst. Yeah. You have seven appointed and five unappointed people sitting around a mahogany table every 6 weeks deciding everything about where the economy is supposed to go, what asset prices should be, the price of money, the price of stocks, the price of bonds, and they think they know best. And I'm not a believer in that model. You know, flat out.
And don't forget that our elected officials have taken upon themselves to totally ignore everything and just say, okay, as long as the markets are up, we're in good shape. I mean, really, the benchmark of everything right now is the markets. Well, real estate too. But it's really the benchmark of everything has become financial assets, and everything else is kind of by the wayside. And, you know, no inflation according to their models. There's you know, no problem in terms of valuations. And, you know, we look at this and listen, we end on this point that it was pretty hysterical or frightening, however you want to look at it, that Janet Yellen also came out with her discussion about social media stocks and healthcare stocks on them being overvalued at the time. Not that they were or weren't, but just the fact that she talked about this was probably one of a defining moments in her career.
Well, sure, but you know that the Federal Reserve now has all the various asset prices up on their trading screens, and they're watching them like hawks, minute by minute. And if they need to, they'll come out midday, mid-market, and make a statement to get certain things going in the right direction, and put air quotes around that. And so what we've had now is, this is, you know, if we back way up, here's my main criticism of this whole thing. Stocks and bonds, cash, currency, derivatives, everything that's financial, those are just claims on real wealth. Real wealth is not money itself. Real wealth is the stuff you can buy with money itself. It's goods and services. It's wheat. It's oil. It's gold. It's productive plant, property, equipment, enterprises, bricks and mortar, real estate. That's real wealth. And the more you continue to compound your claims on real wealth exponentially, and that's what we're doing. This is the main thing. People say, Chris, tell me one sentence what happened. I'm like, look, starting in 1970, we began to grow our credit market debt at twice the rate that the economy was growing. We were compounding our total debts at 8%, and we were growing our economy at 4%. And as an individual, you can't take on more debt at a much faster rate than your income is growing before you get into math trouble. Mm-hmm. And we ran into that math trouble in 2008. And people are like, oh, it was subprime mortgages. Like, sort of, but that was a symptom. That wasn't the cause. The cause was, we had too much debt in the system, and the response of the Federal Reserve was to shut out all sorts of thoughts around that and just say, you know what we need? We need more. We need to repair the credit markets, because what we clearly need is we need more debt in the system, not less. And that, to me, is just the wrong diagnosis with the wrong prescription, and we're headed on the wrong path.
Well, Chris Martinson, I appreciate you coming along. Also, if you want to find out more and buy something with that money you have, well, he's got a book out, The Crash Course. It's available from Wiley, and I think you'll very much enjoy that. We'll have you back again soon. I appreciate you coming on.
Hey, pleasure's been mine.
All right, thanks a lot. Bye-bye. That was interesting. I'm glad we have a change-up of guests on a regular basis so we can hear some other thoughts of people out there, some other commentary, some other ideas. It gets the thought process going on really what's happening out there, not to only have one line all the time, same people on the show always and giving us their same outlook and same insight. So that was good. I think that was actually a really good interview. Let me talk about a few things before we wrap it up today. Number one, Warren Buffett, congratulations. The number two richest man in the world, again, just behind Bill Gates. Awesome. And, well, I mentioned before we got to the guests some of the things that I've been looking at. Now, when we look at the world and the world returns, what's been going on with regard to what's in favor and what's not, I just want to give you a quick rundown of what I've been seeing out there and what you need to know. First of all, Russia is still the laggard in terms of the major countries out there. The ETFs, I'm going to talk about ETFs, which takes into consideration their currency as well. Month to date, in so far in this month, is down about 5%. Year to date, down 35%. Malaysia down 13%. Korea down 12%. Brazil down 12% as well. Mexico down 9%. You can see the trend going here. Now, a lot of that has to do with the fact that, well, the dollar has been rising and the currencies of these countries have been falling. And that, in, you know, when you look at the ETFs, they trade in their own currency. And therefore, unless you find something that's hedged, you're going to also have the add-on effect of what that currency is doing compared to the dollar here as you invest in it. So some of the drawdowns are based on not only the stocks of those countries, but also the fact that the currencies are losing money. You can get the opposite effect as well. As a matter of fact, if you, let's say, for example, let's say that you're in, Japan and you invest in the United States. Well, if the markets are up 10% and your currency is down and the currency of the U.S. is up, well, you're going to get not only the benefit of the stock market move, but you'll also get the benefit of the currency move. So it's a double benefit to you. Now, we have the number one is India. India is up about 33%, Philippines up 21%, Turkey up about 18%. Pretty good stuff. China, large caps, about up 9%, Hong Kong up 5%. Good things. I mean, obviously, these are doing much better, not seeing as much of a currency drag as some of these other places, but big divergence from the Russias, Malaysias, Korea, all the way down to things like Africa, Hong Kong, Taiwan on the plus side. Now, in terms of our markets here, what's been happening if we break down the S&P 500? So I took a look at the S&P 500 spider ETFs by sector, looking at, well, what's done really well and what's been lagging? Well, as you probably know, the biggest laggard, if you don't know, has been energy. Well, of course, energy, that makes sense. You have oil dropping off a cliff here, and energy shares are dropping off as well, down 9% for the year. Now, that's a far run from the next, which is home builders, which are down 0.12%. Consumer discretionaries up 7%, materials up 8%, industrials up 9%. The S&P is up about 12.5% from the SPY ETF, which is, by the way, the one we use for the Aero strategy. We base it all on the S&P 500 in long, out, or short. If you have any information that you want on this or want information on this, of course, you can just contact this on the Aero strategy, which we use an algorithm that we developed to look for overbought and oversold areas, very distinct overbought and oversold, and we invest long, short, or out. And we have a $50,000 minimum for that, but you can find that information on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Now, the top number one, drum roll, please. Healthcare up 27% this year. Now we're already seeing over the weekend, Merck is going to be looking to buy a company in a multi-billion dollar deal. And we're seeing that not only the inversions are really helping along the healthcare, but scientific findings as well as other merger and acquisition activity that has been happening. So really an amazing run. And we've been seeing that this has been a little bit of fits and spurts for the year, but really post, I would say, April, May, it just took off. Healthcare has been doing very well. Utilities are up 20%, technology up 17%, staples up about 13.5%, which I find very interesting because with all the headwinds that we have with the currency right now, with the dollar being as strong as it is, you would think that the staples wouldn't be doing so well. But It's a safety play. It's a high dividend play. Same thing with utilities. And that's really playing out very nicely when it comes to the markets and those particular sectors in the markets. Financials are up, 13% for the year as well. In terms of this month, still seeing that the number one slot is tied between healthcare and financials, two big caps that are doing well. Materials are actually doing well. And, of course, energy is not, continues to really just slide and not do well at all. And Wells Fargo now has surpassed all of the banks to be the world's largest bank by capitalization. Pretty impressive. Warren Buffett probably became number two with some of that added to his bankroll. Pretty interesting. Now, if you have any comments, please send them to me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I would like to hear from you about your GoPro experiences. We'll talk about that in the next few shows. And tell me if it's a novelty in your opinion, if it is something that is going to be long-lasting. Do me a favor. Try to keep the overall emotional exuberance out of it. Try to be logical. Try to tell me your actual experience. I want to hear about your experience with GoPro. If you think it's something that you're going to use for the rest of your life and it's like a have to have, you're going to, every single child you're going to have, you're going to put them in their rooms and watch them grow up. And if you're going to attach it to their, I don't know, a helmet cam somewhere and you're going to be using it, you know, at every sporting event that you go to. I mean, or if it's something that you're like, wow, it's interesting, but I could just use my phone, the camera on my phone to, you know, do what it does. Who needs all that? But try to keep it logical. I'd like to hear from you and get a good showing of people and telling me about their experience, you know, whether you will think that it's going to be something that's going to be a long-term play that's going to be a have-to-have or just a short-term, you know, kind of flash in the pan that's going to be a novelty item that's going to go away. Well, other than that, we're going to end the show on that note. I thank you for joining me. Check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Anything you have any questions on, of course, you can find me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com or Twitter, Andrew Horowitz. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.